Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Well, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson, and I'm just showing Fred, or talking with Fred, about the way I went about solving a fairly common problem in reliability engineering, which is how do we solve a failure if we have no idea how it's failing?
Yeah, and I said, and I tried stopping you right there and going, all right, let's hit record, because this sounds like an episode. So we're recording, but it, and I said, you know, I run into this way too many times. You get, hey, the green light went out. It's not working. And that's a problem. That's a super common problem. And so you get the three experts in the room, right? And they say, well, it's this, it's that, it's this. It's they immediately jump to the solution that they're going to advocate that they can do. The mechanical engineer says, I need to change this bearing. And the electrical engineer says, I need to increase the current, or the, you know, wait a sec, guys. Let's understand the problem first. We have symptoms, but that's it, right?
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you get out of that situation?
Well, first off, you take a deep breath. You find out what your timeline is, because usually it's like yesterday. And you go, that's not going to work. Do you want to really solve this, or do you just want to band-aid it? And you got to get that cover to say you really want to solve it. And then it's step back. I usually rely on the 8D process, which is do the triage. What do you know now? What are the symptoms? What do you know and don't know? And then step through it with more of a failure analysis mindset. Go after that. And brainstorm solutions and experiment to verify them and move on with those steps. And I'm waving my hands and drawing on a board as I'm talking to you. But there are structured ways to deal with that. And it starts with, well, what do you know and don't know, right? What evidence do you have that can rule out or rule in different potential areas of exploration? That's the way I approach it. And I'm sure you do it differently, because you're from the other part of the world.
That's right. The upside down. I think the reality is I don't do it differently to you, certainly not in principle, but it's just how we execute that particular problem-solving technique. And I'm a very visual person, so what I've got in front of us right now is just for a recent problem, I like to draw things. I like to illustrate how we're going to go from where we are now to where we want to be, which is the problem solved. And often I find that reliability engineers can often come on site or come from their department or come from their office or cubicle and give an email dot point brief. And that doesn't work 9 times out of 10, because it doesn't give people a really easy way to understand what they need to do to get from here to where they want to be. So I like drawing the solution structure, at least, and that's what I did with this most recent problem, where I'm certainly not more experienced or know more about the actual technology than the people designing it. That's for sure. So how do we solve it? The first step is, I think you mentioned it, is actually introduce a structure for what we're going to do next.
Yeah. And I find that the structure piece helps, at least here in the States, especially in Denver. I'm going to pick on and the Denver folks, is they'll go straight to the solution. They're going to cowboy it. Oh, I know what the problem is. I'm going to go fix it. And, you know, sometimes these are very, very smart people, and they actually know, and they can solve it. And if they do that often enough, they're seen as genius. And this, which then I usually argue, well, why didn't you solve that in the design that you just created?
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, failures is a form of feedback. We get to learn a lot from that. But when you get a prototype, it's not appropriate, in my opinion, to blame whoever built the prototype. right? Your contractor or your manufacturer or the technician, or it's, oh, it's just a prototype. They almost never work. So we got to just deal with it. As opposed to saying, what can we learn from this failure? And that's the gist that I have the biggest problem with. And that's where a structure comes into place and going, all right, well, let's rule out that it was a manufacturing error in this first prototype, or was it really a design error that makes it impossible to manufacture? Right. Mm-hmm. And that's by putting it up as a structure. And I use the 8D process and getting it visual. It's on the board. We sitting here on this side of the table are solving that problem, which is over there, and we're all on the same side. So it has the advantage of avoiding the I said, you said, and I'm better at this, whoever is the loudest wins kind of conversations. It's one of the advantages. I don't know. You've ever run into that?
Yeah, and I don't think, I think there's a rush to jump to conclusions. Not a lot of the time it can be egos might not necessarily be involved. It's just that genuine desire to make something work. And it's a human tendency to say, well, must be this. Let's try and get this or change this characteristic so that we can make this work as quickly as possible.
Right. There's always this time element, right? There's time pressure always. But it's, and I think it fuels that jump to a solution as much as anything.
But that's right.
It's a false savings.
It is, but it's an understandable human emotional response. Yep. That's where I think a useful reliability engineer is not just going to go in there and sort of add commentary to a proposed failure mechanism. So, yes, it could be corrosion, or no, yes, it could be. It could be a coding area in the software. That doesn't help. I mean, it could be anything. So,
right.
You know, I think a good one goes on site and is able to, like you say, structure the problem. The first thing I always do is let's try and define the problem statement, because that can be actually quite illuminating. And I'll give you an example. One failure mode that I observed for a particular client. It's all based on signatures and how the signature is interpreted. That is, you do something chemically and then you put it into a machine, and the machine has signals for the thing you put into it, and then you make a deduction about what that signature means.
I think I know what product you're talking about. We'll stay out of that, but I'm thinking of like a chemical analyzer that you put a sample in it and it heats it up and it evolves off a bunch of gas. And then the analyzer gives you this little spiky graph that a chemist looks at and go, oh, there's the nitrogen, there's the iron, there's this. You get a when you're talking about a signal out, it's something that still needs to be interpreted.
That's right. And okay. One way what you can solve that problem is maybe you can account for it in the interpretation, which might be an easier way to solving the problem. So what if you define your problem statement up front as something, you look at your example, Fred, as trying to get the right output for a certain condition, then it's not just the failure mechanism associated with the analyzing piece. You could actually have an algorithm in the software interpret those signals and understand if this failure mechanism A occurs, this is what it looks like, and then account for it, and you have solved the problem. That could be sometimes a much more cost-effective way of doing things. But that all comes back to getting the problem statement defined up front. It's not necessarily eliminating the failure mechanism. It's eliminating the effects of that failure mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's an approach. I agree. And it's when it does take some work, but if it's something that you can't design out because of the variability of your samples and the environment and the conditions, and in everybody knows that I'm a physicist, so I don't understand chemistry, but that kind of thing. It's, if you can mitigate or eliminate the effects of a failure of a, and I'm using air quotes here, a failure, because in the end of the day, it doesn't interfere with the decision that's made by the analyst or the interpretation that's rendered, then it's not a failure. It's, I find one of the early steps is what is in and not in the problem set. Where do we draw the boundaries? Right. Well, it's not powered on. Well, is it plugged in? Right. Well, there's no power in the wall socket. Right. Well, yeah. Is that part of our boundary? Do we need to solve the current available to the system, or do we need, is it a problem with our power supply? And if we can eliminate, draw where those boundaries are, is often then it frames where we're looking for the problem or not. In your case, it's, I thought you were going to head into that. Well, how well trained is the person looking at this? And is that a viable place to go for a solution, right? Do they know what they're looking at? But if you can interrupt that and create a cleaner picture of what they need to interpret, or give them, say, hey, this occurred, here's the signal that it represents. I've seen that on a chemical process. Here's an artifact, and it would shade it red, saying this one's suspect. And then it would change the ability of the analyst to interpret it.
That's right. And there's, for example, we look at astronomy imaging. There's, you have errors in terms of the signal you receive at telescopes on Earth. And you can, for example, if the error is caused by atmosphere, then you can eliminate that failure mechanism by designing the Hubble telescope, launching a telescope into orbit so that that failure mechanism is now removed. There's other things you can't do, which is, sorry?
Good example, Chris. Remember they launched the telescope and then they got some aberration in the lens, and so they had to go up and add a fix to it later. So it wasn't as simple as just, well, let's just eliminate the atmosphere. It's like, you got to actually do it right.
That's true. I mean, that's implicit everything I'm saying. Okay. Always an option, no matter what you
that's
do.
Right.
That's right. But what you can't do is eliminate the error induced by galactic dust. There's dust clouds across the cosmos. And so what we need to do is map the dust and use computers to take the dust out of the signal. And then we can see things like that black hole image that recently came out, which was a result of thousands of hours of computing time to try and clean up the signal to get something we could recognize. But we just need to, by getting the problem statement defined up front and getting it right, it makes sure that the team who's going to solve this problem at least is encouraged to think about every conceivable way of solving the problem.
Yeah, definitely. And I years and years ago, I was touring a factory, and it was actually in Texas, in the southern part of Texas. And there's a great big red button that wasn't tied to shutting down the equipment, right? It was, and it wasn't a panic button for other reasons. It was a shut down the line, and it would shut it down safely, and it immediately alerted the subject matter experts and senior management, and they would go to pretty much immediately that team would assemble with whoever hit the button, and it could be an operator. It was one of the very, very few plants that somebody on the production floor, anybody on the production floor, could say, that's not right, and could shut down production, which is very rare in my experience of walking through so many factories, but it's so enlightened. Mm-hmm. And when that team got together, it was very structured. Is why did, is essentially, instead of asking, why did you shut our plant down and cost us $3 million a day, or whatever, blaming them for taking that action, is what's the observation, and how do you define this as a problem, or what's the problem is essentially what they're going after. What do we need to solve today, I think, is the way they phrased it. Mm-hmm. And the person coming into it had to fit into that definition piece. This is what I observed. Here's the outcome of it. Here's evidence of it. Here's what we know and don't know. And they started filling in that police report, so to speak, right? Here's the facts. And then it was, the next question went right into what you're talking about now is this an isolated problem or a big problem? You know, which guides then, do we need to keep the plant shut down, or can we segregate, or can we do other things as in the short term? But long term, do we need more information to understand how do we solve this? But underlying it is, what's the impact? What's the consequence of these observations? How's it going to affect the end product? And then they could make some rational decisions. But in that was a very clear, this is the problem we're trying to solve. But it didn't preclude that it was only a short-term or a long-term problem. It had to be, this is the problem to the customer that we're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Because you don't want to solve your own engineering team's perceived problem. It always comes back to what the customer wants. And the customer needs to be able to make the call in a way. So customer empathy is a big one. And
Exactly.
Similarly, you can't just solve a problem all the time by saying, oh, well, we'll give this customer a workaround, because technically that solves the engineering problem. But if the workaround requires, you know, a three-week training course and, you know, 10 hours of implementation.
And then there's a workaround for the workaround, and
yeah,
there's side effects to the side effects. And yeah, it doesn't work very long.
No, so we need to, again, define the problem. One of the challenges I've also come across is you talked about how do you find the problem, and you gave some examples of power supplies and things like that. And that's very useful if you understand the technologies involved. But there is some time mm-hmm. where this is a highly developmental product. The technology is brand new, and it's not doing what we want it to do. And maybe previous prototypes, which were less constrained, maybe they worked when they were, you know, oversized prototypes, and you try and make the prototype smaller and smaller and smaller to fit into a certain volume. But it might be a technology that has never been used in that way before. And so we don't have a really good understanding of the very clear power, side effects that a lack of power might provide, or a lack of, let's just say, fluid flow or things like that.
Oh, even heat dissipation changes when you change scale, right? Yeah. And it may not have been an issue when you had lots of metal around, but as you shrink it down and put it in plastic, now you're the ability of the system to shed heat, for example, can change, and dimensions change, and electronics, all kinds of stuff changes. And it may not have been, you know, thought through how it affects. Now, one of my very first projects was in polymers, and we use carbon black to as an additive to this polymer to make it sometimes a resistor and sometimes a conductor. It was a self-regulating conduction process depending on temperature. And so all of our testing had to account for the temperature. And we usually just had a nominal temperature we would make any measurements at. And we were so focused on the effect of temperature, we didn't realize until we learned the hard way that pressure also changes the conductivity of the system. So if you put a probe on it and you press hard, you get one reading. If you press lightly, you get a completely different reading. And we're like, So that's why Agnes with the large forearms always gets out of spec on the high side, and Bill with the marathon runner guy with no arms, basically, he's always failing on the low end of the spec, you know, in the products they were testing. Turned out that they were supposed to be using a 4-point probe, which would take out the contact resistance, which is what that affected. And they were using 2-point probes. So once we fixed the measurement system, it actually worked for them. But it was like, why do you get such different answers? And it was an effect that was inherent in the product, but we didn't know about it. It was one of those things that we either didn't think of, or we had dismissed, or whatever, until we started digging into it. But yeah. It's probably a subject for a whole nother episode, is the importance of measurement error in problem solving and everything else.
And I think you sort of almost leading towards the concept of designing experimentation to try and try and work out what the causal factors or singular root cause might be. And then that, at least in your scenario, it sounded like that you did have some information there that you could sort of review and say, okay, well, this was different this time and it worked then, but it didn't work when we're doing it this way. And you could use that in part of your investigative analysis to try and work out what the likely root cause is and then confirm it through some sort of test. But I also always find that if you don't have that level of information up front, it's always useful to write down, let's just call it factors that could be influencing the physical process or the chemical process or the electrical process, which your failure mode is linked to. And I often find that if you try and categorize these factors, then you can really start imposing some structure. So let's just say that you have some location-specific factors. That is, if you're talking about pressure, you talked about in your scenario, Fred, how if you apply pressure to a certain area of component or a subsystem, the pressurized area will respond in a way which might cause failure. That, now that's a particular failure mode signature. So that if you have correctly listed factors which are unique to location, whenever you see any variation in location, or if the failure mode appears in one location, not the other, then you can go to your set of candidate factors that are location specific. And if you have another set of factors which are, you know, uniform across the entire system, that means failure modes who that have, again, homogeneous signals or homogeneous signatures, you know that the factors causing that particular failure mechanism come from the non-location specific factors. And just a simple process of trying to categorize factors into buckets, which you can then link to the signature of each failure mode, that's a very simple process that can quickly yield some substantial dividends based on what you see. And that gives a structure to ongoing investigation and ongoing analysis to try and, again, solve the problem. And I know that's working quite well in one of the applications I'm working on right now.
What I find having a good structure when you do the failure analysis and using some basic tenets like, what do you know and don't know? What's the evidence that you have? And those factors would be, well, what are the, it's like a mini FMEA. What are the potential elements of our environment or process or design that could influence and lead to this particular failure? And then looking for patterns and all of those elements of it. One of the tenets is, well, graph it. Put it on a chart, put it on a wall, draw what you know and don't know. I'm thinking of all these factors and the different kinds of elements that would lead to failures. Besides just being a list, I'm thinking of a big bubble diagram, like a Venn diagram. You know, these two things have to be in, like, electromigration. You need a electric field, a contaminant, I'm drawing a blank. You need a couple different elements. And if they're not present, then it's not going to happen. Where if you have galvanic corrosion and you just need dissimilar metals and some current, and you're going to get this corrosion. If one of those elements is missing, it's not going to happen. So you can bucket it pretty quick. I think of Venn diagrams when I think of that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
This one goes into it. Now, how do you keep it from exploding into a whole big PhD project, which I know many of the engineering teams I've worked with realize they don't have the luxury of doing that?
I'm going to bring it back to illustrations. I find that just keeping it, don't have a report, have a graphical representation of the problem, the structure, the process. And I think that does a couple of things. It allows people to quickly grasp the problem. Just, you can look at a picture and we are visual creatures. So you can see that if you've got a diagram of the component in question and that list of factors is actually in a really aesthetically pleasing way, linked or references every part of that component, You can just look at it as a simple diagram and say, okay, that thing up there, that thing there, that thing there, that thing there. Okay, all these things are candidate factors for what's going on. Mm-hmm. But I also think that as soon as you talk with illustrations, it promotes that childlike curiosity in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes a clear statement to all concerned that this is not that PhD project. We're not interested in having a double-blind study. We're not interested in publishing our reports in a journal. We are just trying to provide a structure that makes sense to our inner child, because the childlike curiosity is what we're trying to encourage and foster, children's curiosity is unbiased. It's not, by definition, it's not informed.
You know, that's really the key point, I think, to what do you do when your prototype doesn't work? An engineer comes in and goes, oh, I know what it is. You got to plug it in. And obviously that's an electrical engineer. And another one is, well, it's not level. So that's mechanical engineer, and so on. It's that unbiased view of it. You know, I really don't know. And I think that's one of the advantages we have as reliability folks, especially in consulting. We don't have 5 years of in-depth knowledge of your technology when we walk in the door, but we certainly can ask some questions that you may have forgotten the ability to ask. And it's that naivety, is that the right word? Or it's, I think more appropriate, it's the lack of bias. We don't have those filters on yet. We don't have those glasses on that limit our view of the thing. And getting an organization or a team, even if you're brought in to help problem solve something, like, hey, the proto's not working, it's work to bring back that piece of it. And what you're suggesting, and I agree with you, is that put it on the wall, draw it, put an exploded view of your product up there and start listing those factors and laying it out with any intent to open up that view, the wonder of, I often come out of those kind of meetings going, why does this thing even work at all, ever? You know? But I think that's the core piece. It's the, if anybody wanted to take, the key message away from this one, it's that. That's the one I would look at. Sorry, I know you like drawings, but I think whether you draw it or whatever the technique is, and I think drawing's a big part of it, is you got to allow yourself to be in wonder. It's probably another way to phrase it. That makes sense?
Yeah, I agree. And maybe it's not drawing per se. It's just don't write a thesis, because that kills wonder. That kills that uninhibited curiosity that you want to promote. So, and people can do it verbally. People can really control a room and make sure that happens as well. And going back to your point, the naivety of the reliability engineer, I think what the real trump card we have is when we go into on site or go and help somebody out is we're not embarrassed if we don't know what this technology is all about.
That's right.
And there are no doubt a bunch of people on each team who don't know everything as well as perhaps they think other people expect they should. And that is an inhibitor to genuine dialogue. So we can sit there and ask, why is that red? That's and right. If we get a few blank faces, that's right. I mean, that was a question that people were afraid to ask, and now I've asked it, so we get to deal with it, and we have a very comprehensive structured approach as a result.
That's right. Yeah. No, I agree. So are you going to put this a graphic, not the one that you're actually working on right now, but the structure template, or if that's the right word for it, in the show notes? Is that you going to be able to do that? Or something like that?
I think I should be able to do that. And maybe after we finish this conversation, you can give me some more constructive, not PhD thesis bullet pointed feedback on how I could take it to the next level and make it generic. But yeah, I'm sure I could do something that could at least allow people to talk about how valuable illustrations can be and how it relates to their experiences.
Yeah. No, and I just remember, I know when we first started talking about this before we hit record, I said, oh, there's this organization, I think they're called The Grove. In the years and years ago, I took some classes from them. It was all about drawing and using templates to as agendas for meetings or for problem solving or for brainstorming or for visioning exercises and all kinds of things like that. I'll do a quick check, see if they're still around or not, and we'll add that if they're out there, because it was invaluable for decades for me and to this day of working with a group of people and making it visual. It has so many advantages, and it sounds a lot like what you're doing here. I almost forgot to say that. So
hi, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, let's wrap this one up. I mean, if you've been listening to this, we kind of wandered around a little bit, but hopefully there was enough structure there that you got the idea that if something's not working, it's really about, well, how do you help that group or that team or yourself go about in a structured way, not to overuse that term, Chris, to get to a solution. And it's not the one-off process. We all have experienced and gnash our teeth at, because while it works sometimes, it doesn't work consistently. And so having especially for difficult, complicated systems, we don't want to treat symptoms. We want to solve the problem. So the idea of getting it visual, of opening up yourself and the team to wonder and to have no bias and to ask the questions that need to be asked to get a better understanding of what's going on, often gets enhanced by just making it visual and putting it up on the wall or on the screen and open it up so that it's a more open process, and then have the structure in place to go, well, here's what's next. We're going to do this segment or section now, and then we're moving on to these other steps, and we'll make decisions and move on. But this process leads us to a solution, and that adds a lot of value to a lot of interactions. So, what's your take on it as a listener? What, you know, do you use something like this, and do you have any good references for that, or areas that are useful techniques for you? I know I mentioned 8D process, and I know there's others out there. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR and let us know what's working or not working for you. And if there's sticking points, we'd love to hear about those, because most likely would make a great topic for a future episode. By and large, we've been getting one or two ideas or suggestions for podcasts lately, almost every week. Last week we had three. The week before we didn't have any. So I'm saying we're getting feedback and really, really appreciate it. And those ideas and suggestions are working their way into many of our topics. So we'd love to hear from you, and we'll get your ideas and concepts into the discussion. It's your way of joining us. So with that, Chris, I think we'll wrap this one up. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability.
All right, great, thanks.
We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.